This is the second tape in a series by Dr. Robert C. Newman, professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Well, we've looked so far this morning at the Old Testament background, a couple sections under that. We looked at creation, saw the distinction there between absolute ownership and stewardship or trusteeship, and pointed out that all individuals, all governments, etc., really fall under the category of stewardships under God, rather than the category of ownership, having absolute authority on what they're dealing with. We looked at God's universal dispositions, the Adamic and the Noachian, and saw how certain things were handed over to man by these. Power over the earth, over the plants, over the animals, and over other men, and that these powers extended to the point not only of eating plants and cultivating, and not only of ruling the animals, but also of eating the animals, and not only of ruling men, but ruling men to the extent of life and death under the Noachian disposition. And then we looked at several examples showing how God sees these things as still in force all the way up through the Old Testament prophets. Now we'd like to look briefly at God's limited dispositions, Abrahamic, the Mosaic, the Davidic, the New Covenant, that sort of thing, just a very few observations in relation to these. These I call limited dispositions rather than universal dispositions because the previous dispositions or covenants applied to all those who were living at the time they were given. Adamic covenant was given to Adam, Eve. That was all of the living, all mankind. So I'm not talking about the angels and such. And the Noachian to all living at that time. But these don't. These apply to restricted groups at the time of enactment, although some of them may become universal eventually. So the Abrahamic covenant applies to Abraham and to his descendants, and we understand that through Jesus Christ, those who are not descendants of Abraham come into that covenant because they become descendants through him. They're identified with him. A Mosaic covenant appears never to be a universal covenant. The Davidic covenant, however, rulership involves eventually rulership over the whole earth. We'll spread to that eventually. The new covenant will be rulership over all people in the new heavens and new earth, though that's not all people universally. But we can see how these spread then gradually that way. Say a word or two about the Abrahamic disposition then. This is mentioned in Genesis 12, 13, 15, 17, 22. I think that covers all the chapters that explicit statements of this are given in. Basically, Abraham is selected out from among the other nations. He's given specific promises of blessing, which you don't see much of before that. There's a hint when the curse is given that this is not the end, that from the seed of woman will come one who will crush the head of the serpent, but not a great deal more said in that direction. At the Noachian covenant, there is a promise that there will be no more judgment just of that sort, which had been given before, but reserved several other varieties of judgment by implication. So not particularly a blessing in that sense. But here in the Abrahamic disposition, we definitely have some promises of blessing added. No explicit form of government is established. So here's an arrangement made which apparently does not involve a question of government. So you begin to see here kind of an implicit separation of some sort of religion. Right? This particular arrangement doesn't set up a government. May imply that some kind of a patriarchal operation will continue. Such an operation was apparently in existence already, although we've not got much evidence to base that on before this period. I would say Job is probably going to be it. Whether Job comes before or after Abraham, it's rather apparently an arrangement that's not under Abraham's disposition, under his covenant or dispensation. Okay, now we move on to the Mosaic one, which, as we see, takes up a substantial fraction of the Old Testament, Exodus through Deuteronomy, and then a great deal of commentary on it for the whole rest of the Old Testament, not to mention a number of remarks about it in the New Testament. Here, we do have a government established, a specific form of government, and particular other office bearers that have either governing or religious functions, or both. So we have the priest, king, and prophet. Three offices are established, which interact with one another and have different sorts of functions. The priest one seems to have no governmental functions. Entirely religious operation. The prophet has some combinations, and the king is pretty well a governmental operation. And as we see in here, the priest and the king are kept quite clearly separate all through this arrangement given to Moses. So, for instance, the priest in Exodus 28 and 29 is established, chosen by God, but it's chosen by God to be a dynasty. The sons of particular people will function as high priests. So it's set up at the beginning by special revelation, but it operates by natural succession thereafter. Doesn't need special revelation to keep it going each step down the line. Its functions are clearly delineated by the law. You might ask yourself, who is to enforce these? Who is to see that the high priest wears this, doesn't do this, etc.? That's an interesting question. I'm not going to answer it for you. But it implies some kind of a legal structure that will be in operation and would then apparently involve either a ruler, a judge, a king or something, or a group that will enforce the law. No governmental functions for the priest. The king is outlined in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20. He's chosen by God, but is to be set up by the people. When you want a king or something, it says you'll set up the one I choose. And it's interesting, here's one that's set up and it's not put in force right away. That's a very interesting statement to me about government. Here's God makes provisions for kingship, but doesn't put it in effect. Leaves it setting for a while. I would gather he is desirous of teaching them that there's not just one way to have a government. That different sorts of things can function. So they function for a long time with Moses as the ruler, and then with Joshua as a ruler. And when he dies, apparently God made no provision for an executive officer for the whole government, but will occasionally raise up a judge to bail them out of problems. But otherwise, they have some sort of what we might call a multi-state government, a tribal government. The function of the government is merely to keep people to the law, to keep people to the Mosaic law. They don't see the government as having a function of getting together and making up a new set of laws all the time, something which I think our country has at least had a tendency to drift into. But have a function. Here's a set law, and it's just a matter of operating. So you have almost no legislative branch. You have a judicial branch, and the judicial and the executive are together. So, but the king is set up, but not put in force for a long time. Now, finally, when God chooses David as king, but you remember God also chose Saul as king before that, when God chooses David as king, he makes a dynasty out of that, makes a succession out of that, and sets up covenant. It's a permanent covenant. So he sets it up so it's a permanent covenant. But before that time, they have had individuals particularly chosen, as we have with Moses and Joshua, and leaders who are raised up in times of stress, such as the judges, and a king who is set up but is apparently not given a dynasty, such as Saul. So you see really a variety of governments that are all, in a sense, established by God. And then finally, this one is put in force. It's interesting to see the restrictions in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20. That are put upon this king. You will set a king over you, verse 15, whom the Lord your God chooses. Interesting there. Kind of a combination. God's choice, your establishment. You set him up. Sort of a working sort of thing. Not, I stick a king over you and you shut up and do what you're told sort of thing. You see this peculiar combination also in the church government in the early period too, where the apostles say, it's not fitting for us to be waiting on tables, we're supposed to be doing this and this. You select out certain men and we'll appoint them over it. So a kind of a sharing situation. But that's not what I'm concerned about here principally, but the restrictions which God puts upon this king, he shall be an Israelite. He'll be an Israelite. I will set a king over you from among your countrymen. You may not put a foreigner over yourself. So some sort of idea that the rulership involves the people living in the area. Now here there's all sorts of complications with the distinction between Israelite and Gentile, which it would be hard then to say how much you can press it at this point, but might suggest something of that sort, particularly when we think about the remarks regarding foreign aggression that we saw in Amos, where there were very strong statements made against doing this and this, where you've gone into another country, and therefore you're putting a king over them that's from outside their country. Then further, it says, he shall not multiply horses for himself. Today, that would sound like, well, he's not to be wasting all his time with race horses or something like that. But when you think back to the context there, it's a military statement. Horses were not used for plowing fields. It was not until the Middle Ages that they developed a method for a horse to pull a plow. It has a rather complicated harnessing arrangement that allows a horse to be able to exert force enough to pull a plow. So horses did almost no drawing. They drew light chariots, and they rode people on the back. They were strictly military operations. So he's saying, the king shall not multiply tanks, airplanes, etc. Intention, obviously, is the country is not to be engaged in building up a militaristic force for purposes of aggression. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself. Obviously, the things that suggest to us, I suppose, polygamy, promiscuity, things of that sort, well, they're there. I think that's implied. But as important as anything, I think, again, is the use of wives and the reason why kings had 60 and 80 and 100 and 200 and 500 of them is alliances. To make an arrangement between some tribe on your borders that you wanted them to stay put and not always come charging in and wiping out your people in the area, you'd make an alliance, and the alliance would be sealed by marriage. So it pictures the sort of thing of getting into all kinds of alliances that are going to mean that you can't do what you think you ought to do. You've got to do what you've agreed to do. You've agreed to back these guys up if they get into some kind of mess. They got into a mess they shouldn't have gotten into, but you've agreed to back them up. But you've made an agreement to your own hurt. And God says it's all right for people. In fact, a sign of a righteous person is when he sticks to his agreements, even though they hurt him to do it. But it also, the Bible makes rather clear, you're not supposed to make agreements that will muck you up in that direction. So the entanglement of alliances, I think, is hinted at here. Not to mention at all, which is quite important, the whole matter of idolatry that would be introduced in this way, too. When you bring in these people, it's a diplomatic situation. The wives, therefore, have to be allowed to retain some of their culture and bring in their own religion, whatever it is, and you see how Solomon got into all that mess. Definitely some remarks in that direction. And then it says, nor is he to multiply gold or silver excessively, nor shall he greatly increase gold and silver for himself, verse 17. It's rather clear that you can't have a government without some money. And the king has to have a certain amount of money to operate that way, whatever kind of government. The government's got to amass money. So it doesn't restrict that, but says greatly. There's always a tendency for government to spend and spend and spend and spend. Didn't start with the 20th century in the United States. Didn't start with Roosevelt and the New Deal. Been around throughout human history. Frugal governments are about as rare as hen's teeth, as they say. So you can see that's a problem here, and a problem which comes up not just here, but when Samuel's explained to them all the mess they're going to get in with their government, when they set up a king, he's going to take your daughters to make fancy confections and stuff for state banquets, and your sons are going to have to go out and hew stone and wood and stuff to build snazzy palaces and such. And that really does happen. All you have to do is live in Washington for a while and see all the hewn stone down there. They're spending your money. Well, anyway, back to the subject. So we do have a government set up with some restrictions. The Bible knows nothing good of absolute monarchy given to men. It's a limited monarchy. It's limited by God, though. And that's a rather important thing, as we see when we get into the New Testament passage. Limited by God, not necessarily limited by men. Limited by God. Okay? Well, and then as I pointed out earlier, the period of the judges and such indicates some ambivalence about the form of government. God is not telling you kingship is the only way to do it. But he did set that up explicitly in certain arrangements. Okay, we better charge onward a little bit. The prophet is set up in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 through 22. He's chosen by God. There will be no dynasty with the prophets. No dynasty. The priests, there's a dynasty. Because they've got a set sort of things they're supposed to do. It's within the ability of humans to do it. Once God has revealed the structure, doesn't need anything more. They just need obedience and such to do it. The kingship can be set up in a dynasty because there are certain principles of fair play, of getting to the bottom of matters, of watching for the welfare of the individuals and things of that sort, which men have enough sense to do, which the Bible lays out what ought to be done, lays out restrictions and things of that sort, and so a dynasty can be set up. You don't have to have the absolutely best person in the nation head the government. Be be nice if you could get it, but you don't have to have it. God arranged a dynasty. But for the prophet, he does not arrange a dynasty, because the prophet is not an operation that functions either liturgically, as a priest does, and therefore can set up a set arrangement, nor governmentally, as the king does, but he is a method of revelation, telling you what God's reaction to a particular thing is, and you can't just sit there and know that. God has got to reveal it. So the prophet is chosen by God, but it's not a dynasty. God raises up individual prophets. Notice, however, in the prophet that speaks a thing that I have not spoken, that prophet is to die. The prophet is to be put to death if he is a false prophet. Who's that by? Is it by God? Does God promise when a false prophet shows up, you will know it because a lightning bolt will come down and reduce him to ashes? No, he doesn't. The only such thing that does do that is at the time of Elijah. And then, whatever the fire from heaven is, it doesn't reduce the prophet. The people kill the prophets. The government, apparently, is given the responsibility of dealing with a prophet. So here is another capital crime that is added to the list. One we had looked at already was murder. Hinadat, when shedding blood by man shall his blood be shed. There are a couple others mentioned in the Mosaic material, but we have not looked at them. But here's another one added, false prophecy. And apparently, the person is to be put to death by the government. That's clear in the context, because they ask, how will we know who's a false prophet? Well, the answer would be, the one who has been reduced to cinders, he is a false prophet, if God promised that he would do the job. But no, he says, the one who says something that doesn't come to pass, he is a false prophet. Don't be afraid of him. Don't be afraid in putting him to death that you're killing a true prophet. You just do the job. Okay? So there's the three things here. Now, I was going to give a long discussion of the interaction of individuals with these officials and of these officials with one another. I have about 20 passages to look at. Let me just say a word or two about each. Interaction of the individual with the king. You remember how David would not kill Saul, though Saul had forfeited his right to be king, which was shown by God by anointing David as king in place of Saul and by taking away the spirit which God had given Saul to be king with. David will not do it because the fellow has been anointed. He says, I'll let God do it. I'll let God do it. And God commends him for that. Saul commends him for that. Everybody commends him for that. David has done right in not killing the Lord's anointed, although that person has been rejected from being king. Now we can contrast this with Hazael in 2 Kings chapter 8, who is told by a prophet he will be the next king of Syria. And he puts feet to his prayers, if you like. And he goes up and takes a cloth and dips it in water so it won't conduct any air, and sticks it over the guy's face. That's the dry cleaning bag of ancient times. And he becomes king very quickly. But we have that picture as a rather unsavory fellow who is taking things into his own hands, where God had promised he would be king, but he does it in a nasty way and then goes on to kill people left and right, as the prophet weeps about when he tells this person he's going to be king, and that opposed to David, who is unwilling to deal with Saul. And how about the individual and the priest? Relationship between the individual and the priest. We see Paul in Acts chapter 23, 2 through 5. The one who said something to this fellow because the fellow makes a very self-righteous remark. And then when he finds out it's the high priest, he apologizes because one is not to speak against the high priest as an officer. So we see the respect that is due to the high priest. And then we can contrast with that the fellow Doeg, the Edomite, in 1 Samuel chapter 22, who kills a high priest, not because a high priest has really done anything intentionally wrong. He has provided David with sword and some food when he was escaping, but he didn't know David was escaping, a person who was willing to kill one whom God had set aside for such an office. So there's also some examples for an individual and a prophet. The one that comes to mind is where the prophet told an individual to strike him. The fellow knew he was a prophet. Told the prophet he was supposed to whack the prophet one so he'd look wounded, so that he could carry out a certain thing, and the guy would not do it, and the person who would not do it is punished for that. Well, then I had a good list of about four or five passages on the relationship between the king and the prophet. We're going to have to pass those. A good example of Rehoboam, who had just lost 2/3 of his kingdom. Whole northern tribes had rebelled. he's all set to lead the armies back to crush this rebellion, and a prophet comes up and says, no, this is of the Lord, you stay put. And Rehoboam, though he did some stupid things and other things, here he was wise, he obeyed what the Lord said, he didn't do it. And that is commended in Scripture, that occurs. And then on the other hand, we see examples of Jeroboam resisting the prophet. Here's a prophet comes up and says, these pagan altars which you have made are going to be destroyed, and the priest's bones will be burnt on them, and the guy who's going to do it's named Josiah. And he stretches out his hand to say, seize that guy. He resists. And we see God's reaction in allowing the prophet to be able to wither the arm of Jeroboam and things of that sort. We see places where God allows the prophets to be killed by the king, but it's rather clear that the kings are sinning in their activity. So a little bit about that. Interaction of the king and the priest mentioned Uzziah, the king who wanted to take over the priestly duties. He wanted to burn his own incense in the temple. And the high priest Azariah tried to stop him, 2 Chronicles 26. And of course, the high priest couldn't do anything. I mean, the other guy's got the army, and he armed some of his priests to, and probably would have killed them all. But as soon as Uzziah came in and started to burn the incense, God struck him with leprosy. And that apparently woke Uzziah up. I mean, he could have continued on doing it anyway, but that apparently woke him up and he stopped it. We see how God kept very clear this kingship and priesthood, kept them distinct, as I suggested earlier, so that Christ could be the king priest to come. Well, we've got to quit there on that section. I had a section on duties of king and citizen, but if we spend some time on that, we'll not get a chance to look at the New Testament material. I want to turn then to the basic New Testament passages, and we've got three of these we want to look at. Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 through 22. Paying taxes to Caesar. I suppose everybody remembers the controversy here, but take a look at it in your Bible. Don't. Pharisees were determined they were going to discredit Jesus. And they finally came up with a thing that they were pretty sure they could discredit him either with the people, and that would then end his being any danger to them, or discredit him with the government authorities, and they would take action against him, and that would force something. So they were pretty sure they could do that. They realized that in Palestine at this time, the Roman government was in power because they had taken advantage of a situation. About a century before this, 63 BC, the Romans had been called in to settle a dispute between the accession to the throne of the Maccabean kings over Israel, and they had settled it by naming one of the guys would be the ruler, but they demoted him from king to a ruler under the Roman Empire. And so the Romans had very quickly slipped in at that point, and they hadn't been gotten out since. So the Romans had come in unasked. I mean, they were asked to arbitrate the dispute. They weren't asked to take up the government. And they were getting rather substantial taxes, at least comparable with our tax rates today. But, well, not graduated like our tax rates today, but comparable for the average person and then some. And the Roman government was not particularly honest. The procurators did not like being sent out in sticks from Rome. And so they figured while they were out there, they were going to at least get enough money so that when they came back, they could enjoy Rome a little more, make up for the difference. So they had a tendency to bleed the places dry or as near as they could. They also, the Roman whole Roman system, hired out the taxes to locals. So locals would bid against each other. I'll give you $2 million this year in taxes if you let me collect taxes. I'll give you $3.5 million if you let me collect taxes, etc. So they would give it to the guy who bid highest. Within certain reason, even botching themselves up several times when the guy couldn't collect that much taxes and they had to bail him out and give him a loan and all sorts of other things that happened now and then. But a background that made the Israelites hate the Roman government situation. It was a foreign government, and God had set up a government for them, which had been taken away. You had a whole spectrum of people there. You had, on the one hand, the Sadducees who went along with the government. They were the high priests and such. But they didn't like the Romans. They just liked what they could get out of the Romans. You had the Pharisees, who went along with the government but didn't take any real part in governing and did not make a lot of money off the governing, and yet who weren't about to advocate any rebellion. You had, I suppose, between these two groups, between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, you had the Herodians, who would like to get the government of the nation under at least alleged Jews, the Herods, rather than under the Romans. It had been under Roman procurators since about 6 A.D. So you have those. And then over to the left side of the Pharisees, you have the Zealots, who advocated violent overthrow of the Roman government. So you really had about as big a spectrum as you've got in our country today. You had people advocating violent overthrow of the government, and you had people advocating law and order, with a huge difference that the government wasn't a popularly elected government. And it wasn't even a native government. It was a foreign government. And you can see that's rebuked in Scripture. And it was all of that. Now, that's without even looking at the religious situation. That's just a political background of this whole controversy. The religious situation is that the Romans were pagans. They believed in many gods. They also believed each person had a kind of godlet of his own, a genius, the god over his own destiny, his individual destiny. And in the outer parts of the Roman Empire, the genius of the Roman emperor was worshipped. And when the Roman emperor himself died, if he wasn't too much of a scoundrel, he was worshipped. So at the time we're talking about here, Augustus was worshipped as God in many places in the Roman Empire. The genius of Tiberius was worshipped as God. So a government over Israel that has pagan features in it, involving worship of men even. The coinage that was used reminded the Jews of this. The denarius, which the tax was paid, which is the coin that shows up here. It's not clear in the King James with a penny, but it's a denarius. Has got an inscription on the front. Tiberius Caesar, the revered one, Augustus. Son of the divine Augustus. So that's a pretty pagan-sounding title, certainly. And then on the back, it had the guy's mother. And she was seated on a throne in a pose, I believe it is, of the goddess of victory. So certainly the coin had many serious pagan problems. That's a background, actually, to this whole confrontation that occurs. So basically, the dilemma then, the confrontation which the Pharisees are going to try and catch Jesus with here, is this. They're going to ask him, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And if he answers yes, they'll say, aha, he is collaborating with the Romans. He is condoning acceptance of Tiberius' religious claims to be son of the divine Augustus, etc., all of that. On the other hand, if he says, no, it's not right, well, they brought the Herodians along. And the Herodians, who are concerned to support the Roman government, because they're never going to get Herod back in power unless the Romans put them back there, they just go and tell Pilate, and Pilate's going to have to do something. In fact, we realize that at Jesus' trial, that is the charge that they were able to scare Pilate enough with, was that if you let this guy go, you are condoning rival claims to power, Caesar. So we have to understand that this is just not made in just sort of a neutral situation. It's not a situation where some guy standing up on a soapbox downtown here saying, vote for me for president of the United States, and he's some kind of crackpot. Because there would be a question of voting, people have a right to vote, person can run for government. This is a person who is in a conquered country where there is already a substantial minority of terrorists who are assassinating people and trying to start a revolt, who would be saying, don't pay taxes to Caesar. And the government had to have the taxes to keep operating, particularly with the welfare programs they had worked up. So you can see the bind they got Jesus in. Unfortunately, they did not count on the fact that Jesus is also God as well as man, and he was ready for them. So here they come, clomping up, ready to wipe him out. And he says, do you have a coin, taxation? Show me a coin, you know? They probably think he's stalling, so they quickly whip out a coin. But in fact, what he's done is he shifted the whole burden of the argument on them. They are the ones who, by producing the coin, show that they're using this coin with the claims to the divinity of Augustus on one side and Tiberius' mother as goddess on the other side, and they're carrying it. And so they're showing that they have solved the problem somehow, whether they think it's insoluble or not. They have solved the problem somehow. They're willing to use the coinage for their own purposes, whether they're willing to use it for taxation or not. So the whole question of idolatry is something which they've already solved. They aren't interested in the real answer. They're interested in getting Jesus stuck. But by having handed this, shown him that they got this coin in their possession, they've lost the argument already. Of course, they don't know it yet, but they've lost the argument already. He says, well, whose picture is this? Whose inscription? Caesar? No, it's Caesar's. They're making all the positive statements. He's just asking questions. And then finally makes a answer, gives the answer, well, repay Caesar. What belongs to Caesar? You've got Caesar's property here. It's got his stamp on it. You know, like we put a stamp on our books, a book plate in it or something like that. It's got a stamp on it. Give it back to him. It must belong to him. But he also says, repay God what belongs to God's. Repay God what belongs to God. Jesus isn't just shooting them down. He's also giving a very crucial principle to the whole thing. So let's have a little look at what the teaching on government is in this passage. Is it saying that there are two spheres of life? Secular and religious. Or there are two powers that be, the church and the state. Gives the state what belongs to the state, and the church what belongs to the church. Well, if he said pay back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and pay the high priest what belongs to the high priest, one might have good argument for that. But when you ask what belongs to God, what does belong to God? Everything. He's created everything. You suddenly see you're not talking about two separate spheres. You're talking about one little sphere and one huge sphere that encompasses that and everything else. So it's looking at two authority structures. And one authority structure covers certain things definitely, but it's got some limitations. And the other one covers everything and has no limitations. The Pharisees had sense enough to see when they'd been shot down. They were used to this type of argumentation. We're not usually used to this one-line argumentation. We usually like it to be all laid out and all the ramifications and everything. But they had sense enough to know when they were shot down, and particularly when the whole mob laughed at them. You know, that's pretty bad. Sometimes when you don't know you're shot down, but everybody else does, you get the idea anyway. But they went back. But what Jesus is really pointing out here is that they were willing to use the good things about the government. They weren't willing to pay for it. And he doesn't leave it there. There's the coin. They were obviously making use of the commercial advantages the government provided. But they're raising the question, well, you should pay taxes to the government. Shall you do your part when the government has done its part? The answer obviously is yes. The government has done its part. Now, that government was not as good as it could be. I don't have any question about that. You can have a lot worse governments than you had then. But I think at the moment we've got a lot better government at the present time. We've got a lot better government than the government that existed at that time. We've got a native government. We've got a government we elected. Taxes are pretty high, but you'll have to admit the guys you elected voted for. Well, some of you guys may deny that anybody you voted for ever paid or voted for this stuff, but I'm suspicious myself. They all turn out to be spenders when they get in there. But we're really in better shape than that. But the government was doing some of the things which governments are supposed to do. The government was keeping order. The government was punishing crimes. The government was making it possible for property to exist. Right? Property exists by God allowing people to work for it, but humanly speaking, property only continues to exist because the government protects you from having it taken away from you by somebody else. So the fact that this guy had a coin to pull out to show to Jesus shows that government was doing its job. And yet they were griping, but they weren't doing their job. They weren't willing to pay the taxes. I mean, they were willing physically to pay the taxes. They didn't. They'd get killed. But they weren't doing it willingly. And he rebukes them for that. And then he moves it on one more step. And I think by implication saying, in doing this, you're also not doing what God requires. God set up that government. You're to be responsible to it. You're not rendering to God what belongs to God. Is obedience to this government, nor in many other things. And I think this remark here, seen in what they were doing with the coin and why they had it but being unwilling to pay taxes, shows us our own attitude towards God. We're willing to take all the good things from God. We're willing to accept health, wealth, friends, etc. But if anything comes along we don't like, we gripe. because we feel, I deserve everything being great, and if anything's out of line, I gripe. Whereas God's attitude is, you don't deserve any of this. It's all gift. You ought to thank God for all of it. And for believers anyway, even the bad stuff is working together for your good. You ought to be thanking God for that too. So this whole attitude of griping, of taking what you can get from God, but not being willing to give back what belongs to God. Very clear there. As the way he handles the coin and showing how they're mishandling the government in this thing, which is a part of what belongs to God too. But then carries it out into the whole realm of all their life. Well, I don't claim I can justify all of that right out of that passage, although I think it's hinted at in the passage. I would claim the justification for that is the whole Old Testament background we've been looking at, plus two explicit statements in Scripture of our responsibility to government, and we want to turn then to these. And the first one is Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. Let every person subject himself to governing authorities. For there's no authority except by means of God. And the authorities which exist have been instituted by God. That's a very strong statement. There is no authority except by means of God. And the authorities which exist have been instituted by God. Who's Paul writing to? Romans. Roman Christians. But he's writing in the Roman Empire anyway. It wouldn't make a difference. When is he writing? Might be off a year. Something like the winter of 57-58 AD. Who's the emperor? Nero. Now, Nero hadn't shown all his colors at this point, but I think we understand that God knew what was going on and put these things in Paul's mouth at that point. That government was instituted by God, even though Nero's mother probably poisoned his adopted father to get him in office. And his previous father had been put in power by the Praetorian Guard when the previous guy died. So, you know, the claims are a little tricky. You know, whenever you start investigating government claims, they're all a little tricky, as we see with the whole American Indian movement. You know, when they begin saying, well, where'd you guys get this government? Where'd you guys get all this land anyway? It used to belong to the Indians. And all of us gulp and say, gads, I hate to turn back all my real estate to the Indians, you know, and try to defend it. And they're trying to hint that you should pay them millions in reparations and things of this sort. Well, no, it was gotten by conquest. Conquest is a problematical thing from the biblical point of view. But in fact, once the government has gotten in power, it is still recognized by God. The people who got it in power are going to have to deal with God as a judgment on how they got there. But the responsibility of the citizens who are under that government, once it's in power, is to obey that government. God is saying, I providentially have allowed that to happen. You have a responsibility to obey that government under the terms in which it operates. So the authorities which exist have been instituted by God. Not the authorities which ought to exist. The authorities which actually exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, verse 2, the one who resists authority withstands the decree of God. You see, in the Jews being unwilling to pay taxes to the Roman Empire, they were resisting God. I take this not to be a special revelation here to Paul, but to be a culmination of the Old Testament teaching that God instituted the governments as they would come, and that Jesus understood this perfectly well, Paul understood this perfectly well, but he's giving it to us by revelation just in case we didn't understand it perfectly well. Those who withstand will receive judgment upon themselves. So, very strong statement made here against anarchism, overthrowing governments because governments are bad in general, or against particular revolutions where a government is to be overthrown because it's not good. Not good. Very funny thing in the Bible, that the authority structure set up by God, they're not absolute. Not absolute. Those people don't have right to do anything they want to with people under them. But they got to face God about it. They don't have to face the men under them about it. Now, of course, in fact, if they start killing off systematically everybody under them, they've got nobody to blame but themselves if one of them decides to kill them first. But that person who decides to kill them first is also going to have to deal with God before that, just as this guy who's been killing off one by one of his subjects is going to have to deal with it, too. So, he who resists authority withstands the decree of God. An absolute individualism which holds then that all governments are wrong, or that you can replace any government you want, is wrong. The Bible doesn't teach that. Those who withstand will receive judgment upon themselves. Then finally, we get in verse 3, the purpose of government. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil works. Do you not wish not to fear the authority? Do that which is good, and you will have approval from it. For it is a servant of God to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for it does not wear the sword for no reason. It is a servant of God, an avenger for wrath to those who do evil. So, rather interesting passage there. Now, we always, you know, you're inclined to think of counterexamples. Rulers are not a terror to good works. And you say, what about Stalin? Wouldn't allow the gospel to be preached. Well, he's going to have to deal with that, of course. And we'll come back to whether there are any exceptions to obedience to government. There are. But this is telling you the basic purpose of government, and all governments do this to a greater or lesser extent. All governments are basically a terror to bad works and not to good works. You will not find a government on earth which will pat you on the back for revolting against it, for stealing, for general murder, or those sorts of things. Governments basically try to keep the total level of sin within their country down. That's a basic situation. Now, they will often try to wipe out Christians in their government, things in the country, things of that sort. But they like the things that Christians do in the way of being hardworking citizens and paying their taxes and not stealing and lying and cheating and murdering. They're just afraid perhaps the ideology of Christianity may be against the ideology that they're teaching. So you run into situations with Nebuchadnezzar trying to throw the three guys into the fiery furnace, or with Stalin doing this other thing. Yeah, some examples, no question. But basically, all governments, to the extent they're a government at all, are a terror to bad works and not to good works. So it says, one rule that will normally keep you out of trouble with the government is to do what's right. That will normally keep you out of trouble with the government. Do that which is good, and you'll have approval from the government. For it is a servant of God. God established government to do something. It's a servant. It does two things. It protects those who are willing to abide by the law. And it removes from society those who are not. You see, there is one very strong deterrent effect of punishment, particularly of capital punishment. The guy who's been killed doesn't do it again, whatever crime it is. All sorts of other guys may do it again. You may argue whether you know, there's a deterrent effect of capital punishment on somebody that's watching the guy get killed. There may not be. I think there is. I think there's some biblical statements that suggest there is. But you can't deny that the guy that got killed doesn't do it again. So it is a deterrent effect. So we come down to the responsibility of the citizens under the government. Therefore, verse 5, it is necessary to submit two reasons. Not only for the sake of wrath. Now, not only because you'll regret it if you don't, you won't like spending in prison or being whipped or being killed or various other sorts of things, but also for conscience sake. You have a responsibility before God to obey the government. For this reason also, pay your taxes, for it is a servant of God devoted to this very thing. Government is the avenger. Men are not the avenger, right? Jesus says, don't take vengeance. God says, vengeance is mine. But interestingly enough here, he says it's the government's too. God has delegated some of his own right to vengeance on evildoers to the government. Hasn't delegated all of it. As far as we can tell, he has not delegated to governments the right to pry inside your mind and find out what you really think. Now, whether he will have when we figure out a way to do that, I do not know. That's a much more complicated question. But the fact that men can't do it today, is safe to say that he hasn't yet delegated it to them. So then he says, last verse, repay everyone the things due them. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Revenue to whom revenue. Those two words, two Greek words there, phoros and telos. One of them is kind of external taxes, duties import duties, export duties, and the other one is personal taxes, internal taxes in a realm, what we would call sales taxes, income taxes, head taxes, that sort of thing. Okay, you see poll tax occasionally. Where do we see that? In some of the modern translations of the Bible, anyway. That ain't a poll tax the way we think of it. It doesn't give you the right to vote. It means it's a tax on a person for being an inhabitant of the country. You get to pay so much for the privilege. It's a privilege. So, okay, repay everyone the things due to them. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Revenue to whom revenue. Respect to whom respect. Honor to whom honor is due. Biblical principle here is it doesn't matter. It does matter, of course. It doesn't matter whether the government is doing everything the way God says it ought to do it. Your responsibility is to obey the government. Right? Your responsibility is to obey the government. It doesn't matter whether your parents are exactly the model of biblical parents, you are to honor and obey them. So the Bible says. They have to face God with whether they've been the kind of parents they're supposed to be. Doesn't matter whether your pastor is the kind of pastor that God says he ought to be. You have certain responsibilities, pastor, elder, etc., because they are that office. They're going to have to face God with how they've done the office, and you're going to have to face God with whether you have honored them, obeyed them, etc. But we should say something else here. I don't have a passage that's explicitly on it. I could give several examples, but I don't have a passage that's explicitly on it. And that deals with the question of, are there ever any times when it's right to disobey the government, the pastor, etc., the parent? Yes, of course there are. Of course there are. I hope the pastors don't feel too bad that are here. There's certainly plenty of parents here, too. I don't know how many government officials there are. None of them have an absolute authority. Everybody's authority is under God. If that person commands you to do something that God has commanded you not to do, you not only have the right to disobey that person, you have to disobey that person before God. And if that person commands you to do something that you're not supposed to do, that God says you can't do, or if he commands you not to do something God has commanded you to do, you have to obey God rather than men. But that, as far as I can tell, is the only out that God gives in relation to the authority structure. And that is where they contradict what God has said to do, you must do what God says rather than what that person says. Got to look at one more passage. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 through 17. This adds another dimension that's not explicitly mentioned in these others. Beloved, I exhort you as aliens and temporary residents on earth, apparently, to avoid fleshly desires which wage war against the soul. This will sound like the Living Bible, but have a beautiful lifestyle among the Gentiles. That's a fair translation, I think, of the passage there. So that, even when they speak against you as evildoers, they may observe some of your good works and glorify God in the day of his visitation. Very interesting. Now, this is talking to believers. This is not just talking to our responsibilities as created beings living on the earth. Almost everything I've said before this falls in that category. All people are under government because God has allowed the governments to come into existence, and they, people as government authorities, have certain responsibilities and such, and persons as citizens have certain responsibilities as such. But here, talking to believers who are aliens and temporary residents, we've got a responsibility in this direction. We have a responsibility to have a manner of life that will be such a thing that even though unbelievers may hate us, they will have to concede at the day of judgment that what they've actually seen us do is good and is praiseworthy. If I understand the day of visitation meaning the day of judgment. It might be earlier than that on occasions. You see the Pharisees there in Jesus' day, whitewashing the tombs of the prophets. Right? They weren't whitewashing the tombs of Jeroboam and Ahab and such, although if they'd been back there, they'd been on their side. Even unbelievers, two generations later, are often on the side of the believers that are safely dead. So you'll find all kinds of heretics praising Augustine, Luther, and various other worthies in their particular groups back a ways who would be rolling over in their graves were they empowered such. To think that these guys are riding on their coattails. But I think we see that here. Have a beautiful lifestyle among the Gentiles so that even when they speak against you as evildoers, they may observe some of your good works and glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, then he applies all of this Even though we're aliens, temporary residents, we're exhorted to have a beautiful lifestyle, he applies it to our relationship to government. Submit yourself to every human institution for the Lord's sake, whether to a king as ruler or to governors as one sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the approval of the righteous. See, exactly the same point made in Romans 13. The purpose of government is the punishment of evildoers and the approval of the righteous. They are sent by God, so you're to submit yourself for the Lord's sake, for in this way it is the will of God by your righteous acts to silence the ignorance of foolish men. It is very hard to speak against a person when what they're doing turns out to be good. They're showing proper respect for authority. You can't fault them. They're saying things need to be improved in this government, but they're obeying the laws as they stand in the government. They're not saying, let's turn these guys out and change the laws and things of that sort. They may want to change the laws, but they try to do them through the proper channels. And those channels will vary depending on what government you're in. We happen to be in a government where you can be rulers occasionally, at least for 10 seconds while you push all those little buttons down on the, those little arrows, I guess they are, down on the voting machine. And when you write irate letters to your congressman, trust they're not too irate, but act as free men, he says, verse 16, and do not hold your freedom as a pretext for wickedness. Don't have your freedom as a pretext for wickedness, but act as slaves of God. See, free men, you're not a slave to any man. You're not going to do what he wants you to do just because he wants you to do it. You're going to do it because God instituted that authority. He may have made that person a government official, which means you were to honor them, or made that person a church official, you honor them. You're not supposed to use your freedom as a pretext for wickedness, speaking against anarchy, but you're to act as slaves of God, speaking against a statism where, you would say, the state, I have to obey the state. You know, I was in that position. He was my authority. He said, kill all those people. I kill them. But if you know that God commanded you not to kill those people for that sort of reason, you don't do it. God's commanded, see? Obey God. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood, that's believers. Fear God. Honor the king. So we see here, purpose of government again. Notice an added feature of the purpose for believers, though. Believers are to live this way, living faithfully under unfaithful, unrighteous governments that fall short, so that in the judgment, the righteousness of their actions may be manifest, if not before. The lifestyle of the Christian is supposed to be so unusual in this direction that it will attract considerable attention from people while they're even living, and even from the worst enemies who blaspheme God and slander believers, they're going to have to admit in the judgment that that type of action towards government was right. Well, that's basically where we are. We might come back and look at this first sheet again and see if we've been able to solve any of these questions on here. It looks like you have different arrangements over different periods of history. You can see different arrangements in the functioning. So it may well be questioned, you know, what arrangement was set up to be operating during a church period? Good. That. But arguments on the inherent wrongness of certain features, rather difficult. Anytime episcopacy would be understood to mean the guy can do anything he wants, that's obviously violating anything Scripture teaches. And anything congregationalism is structured to think that the congregation can do anything it wants, that's certainly violating scriptural principles. And any time a presbytery thinks they can do anything they want, they're violating scriptural principles. Eh? There's no government that can't be misused. And most of the governments will work all right if you try hard to use scriptural principles. What about the situation over here? I didn't really get to work at this much. The state is an enemy occasionally, but we're not to treat the state as an enemy. We're to treat the state as a servant of God, designed for our good. We're certainly to be citizens. It's not at all clear that believers are only to be citizens. One would have to make a very definite dispensational argument to show somehow citizens, they cannot be rulers. You'd have to prove that. The biblical pattern as we see it that covers the whole period is that believers are seen both as citizens and as rulers. As rulers, they have very strong restrictions on what they can and can't do. We saw a few of them in Deuteronomy 17, regard to both the horses and the money and the women. And we saw what those seem to have to do with. There are restrictions. But the citizen's responsibility is not to be ruler over the rulers. The citizen's responsibility is to do his job. And if in our government he becomes ruler for a day, every November, every second, I can't remember what it is, it's a Tuesday in November sometime, it's the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, then you have to follow Deuteronomy 17. By the way, I left out an important passage in Deuteronomy 17 by oversight of some sort, and that was that the king had to copy out a copy of the law and read it and become completely familiar with it. So when you go pull that curtain and start pushing down those little arrows, remember your responsibility to read the law carefully, God's law carefully, and push down those little arrows. Agreement with that. But when you've opened that curtain again and you're back to being a citizen, you have a responsibility to obey that government and to honor the government officials. And you still got to honor the government officials even when they tell you to do something that's wrong. You just don't do it. But you still honor them in taking the punishment that's meted out. Well, do we get back to a help on the relation of church and state? No, I don't think so. The church and the state are both set up by God. They're both under God. We can see arrangements in which both of them are in one person, as in the case of Melchizedek. We can see arrangements in which the state has functions in which it punishes people who do wrong, even though they are religious functionaries. The requirement of the scripture of a prophet to be put to death if he's a false prophet. The state has authority. But on the other hand, when the prophet's doing his job, he can tell a ruler that what he is doing is not right. And that ruler before God is responsible to do what the guy says. So when this prophet shows up to Jeroboam and says, don't you go up there and try to take those things back because God has commanded that this is from him. It's a punishment for what you have done wrong. You leave it alone. Rehoboam did right in staying home. Right? We see interactions both back and forth. There are places where the church has a right to tell the state what they ought to be doing. The state has a right to tell the church what they ought to be doing. The state has a right to intervene if some guys are doing something in their church groups that are killing people or various other things that they may feel are sufficiently wrong. A state has a right to intervene if somebody runs off with all the money of a congregation and goes off somewhere, you know? So that's a church matter. Oh, right to it. And the church has a right to say, we believe that it is not right under God to have adult bookstores. Not that we have anything wrong with adults reading. It's just what's meant in our culture by, quote, adult bookstores. So you see a real interaction there. There's an independence, and yet both have responsibilities that will affect the activities of the others.